Father's Day is coming up, and I wanted to offer something useful to dads who are tired of living a divided life. So I'm hosting a live workshop called Become a Better Leader by Becoming a Better Dad. Here's the core idea. We are not two different men, not a work self and a home self. We are one engine. And when there's a crack in how we lead at home, impatience, disconnection, reactivity, it shows up at work too, just in a different form. Because the real issue isn't our behavior. It's the patterns we fall back on when we don't have anything left. I call that version of us default dad. He's the one who shows up when we're tired, overloaded, or distracted. And while that pattern is easiest to spot at home, it affects our leadership everywhere. This workshop is a practical playbook to help you catch default dad earlier, lead with more intention under pressure, and become a calmer father and stronger leader. It's free. Consider it my Father's Day gift to dads. The link to register is in the show notes below, or visit ambitiousdads.com. Welcome to another Ambitious Dads podcast. I am your host, Jeff Hittner. After more than 200 conversations with fathers, I realized we're just not talking enough. Not about our fears, nor our ambitions, nor how our kids are really doing, or how we're holding up in the middle of all of it. This podcast is for the dads trying to build something meaningful and be present at home. The ones carrying a lot, questioning if they're doing enough, and craving honest conversations without the filters. If that's you, you are not alone. You're in the right place. Let's figure this out together. And today I have a wonderful guest, Kehi, who is a former Wall Street managing director. And Kehi walked away from a seven-figure salary to redesign his life around creativity, presence, and of course, fatherhood. He is a father to two girls, 11 and 8. And he now has moved his career in a new direction, which we'll also talk about, focusing on AI, because that's what you do when you are allowed to lead with your curiosity and your purpose. And he lives in Southern California with his family. Kehi, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here. And I love everything that you do in this domain and others. So it's an honor.
Thank you so much. Well, first of all, we were just talking about this offline. So tell me, you have actually evolved into a new career for yourself. But tell me how fatherhood kind of front and center has placed all these pivots and evolutions in your career over the last, say, 10, 11, 12 years since you started your family.
Yeah. So I would say that you can kind of view it as three chapters, right? And so the first chapter is the no kids chapter. It's still the longest chapter. But if you take adulthood, I had my first child at 35. So there was a 14-year chapter of, you know, married for part of that, you know, no kids. And that was a very, you know, hard charging, driven, wake up at 5 a.m., you know, networking dinners every night, you know, that kind of life, 60, 70, 80 hour work weeks in New York City in finance. The next chapter was about a year after my daughter was born. And I had this theory that I called the magic window, which is this hypothesis at the time that your kids, you're the center of your kids' universe for, let's just say, like, give or take 10 years. So, you know, if you have three kids, it's probably like 15-year window. I have two, so maybe it's like 10, 12-year window. And I just wanted to be there in that window. I wanted to, I am the primary breadwinner. So, like, I was, and my wife's the primary caretaker, but we weren't going to be 50-50 parents, but I wanted to be much closer to 50-50 than, you know, 90-10 that I would have been if I had stayed in finance. And we could talk about all the changes and sacrifices that entailed, professional, leaving money on the table, setting very firm boundaries, not doing guys' trips, you know, basically like deprioritizing things that were important to me that were not core to being a great partner and dad in that window. And that window has kind of ended. You know, it's my eldest is 11 now. And I'm just not needed nearly as much. I don't feel as much guilt when I travel. You know, friends play a much bigger part of my kids' lives. Social activity, extracurriculars play a much bigger role for my kids. They're both dancers. And that kind of led me to try my hand at something new, a next chapter in entrepreneurship focused around AI training and strategy. So that's the kind of the three chapters.
Very cool. Let me jump into this magic window kind of closing, because I'm getting anxiety just thinking about that, because I'm in that beautiful phase now, right? I have an 8-year-old and a 5-year-old. So how has that been emotionally for you, particularly having sort of redesigned your life around your family to see them grow in the most natural, wonderful ways into their friends and into their independence? But there's so many dads that ask me this all the time. Like, how am I going to deal with that? Like, what has it been for you emotionally? And then beyond that.
I think it's definitely, I think my youngest is still in it. So I still have one, but it's definitely bittersweet. And so, you know, things that you took for granted, it would be weird if I laid in bed with my 11-year-old daughter, before bed. And so that probably, I never, maybe she's sick or something, that might change, or something bad, happens. Something scary happens, or she has a nightmare. But, that's bittersweet, right? But at the same time, that same daughter, for the first year of her life, she needed me to hold her hand while she fell asleep, which was incredible and also hell on earth. Right. I mean, she couldn't fall asleep unless you were holding her hand. Oh. And there's only so many podcasts you can listen to. So I think that, I definitely there's an innocence that has been lost a little bit. I think actually the harder thing is that, we fought really hard. She was one of the last kids in her school to get an Apple Watch. But if anything, I think the harder thing is we've lost her a little bit to text messaging. That's probably the harder thing than losing the snuggles, because I think there is a little bit of a loss of presence, which as adults we all know. And I think, I'm a big believer that life is lived in seasons, and I don't think I wanted that season of magic window forever, because you can't now my daughter decides where we eat. I'm cool. I didn't realize I'm sick of deciding where we eat. I would like someone else to make that decision and have a strong opinion about it. And they go even further, research places. And so we were in Japan and for spring break, and both girls, they basically decided all the activities we were going to do. So I think, there are all these, I'm a huge rap music fan, and my kids love rap music, and they're dying to go to a rap concert, which they're not ready for yet. But I could see going to a rap concert with my eldest in 2 years. But I've already taken her to pop concerts. So we go to concerts together now. I was going to say Beanie Baby, not Teletubbies concerts, but The Weeknd or, big Bad Bunny, we haven't gone to those specifically, but those type of concerts. And so now a big thing is just tracking who's coming to tour, seeing how much tickets cost, and if they clear the threshold on appropriateness, right? And so I would have never, and while I was holding my daughter's hand, I would never thought that we're gonna go to a rap concert together.
So fascinating. And what about in terms of your identity, how have you felt that shift, if at all, in the course of this? Has it just felt natural, or are there these sudden sort of tensions or moments where, it's she doesn't want to have anything to do with me, like going to bed or that sort of thing.
Not necessarily an identity, because the identity, at least the way I see it for myself, is like, how do I give her the love and the environment and support that she needs to thrive as a human, right? And like, so that hasn't changed one iota, right? That will, like, you know, I'm sure that my parents, who are approaching 80, think that about me still today. So in many regards, like, that is kind of like unbreakable in a sense. I do think that there are some challenges in like ambition, for example. So like, I grew up in very kind of like tiger style parenting, where like academic excellence was like non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. And it's a really interesting thing, because like, so like academic professional excellence is like a part of my identity, but I'm not like sure that I also know how much suffering comes with that identity. So like, I'm not sure. So where I get conflicted is like, my daughter doesn't have that. Like, she doesn't, she's actually a straight A student, but she just doesn't have this like academic drive that basically you only get in a household where parents like force you to like strive. And I'm torn, because there's a part of me that wants, you know, it's kind of like, just like, make that painful investment now and it will kind of pay off in the future. But at the same time, I want, like, I have a lot of friends who went to Ivy League schools and work on Wall Street. They're not like, I wouldn't want that life. Yeah, they're great financially, but many parts of their lives are underdeveloped, or dare I say, like, hurting. Like, I wouldn't want, like, if you're like, you could wave a magic wand and your daughter could be a managing director at, you know, BlackRock, I'm like, I'm not sure I want that for her, right? It's not that I don't want it for her, but like, that's not like the path to happy, like, I'm involved enough to know that that's not the path to happiness for like, you know, human beings writ large.
Well, it sounds like you're talking about values, right? And so obviously, like, one of the values that you're not kind of screaming at the top of your lungs is this, you know, like, academic version of or definition of success. So what do you think are the values, especially as someone who has kind of given yourself the space to, you know, lead as a parent, and how do you feel you've sort of created those values in your family?
Yeah. Well, my wife is much more like, I might be smart. My wife is wise. Right. And so I think that, I mean, we want the values. I've never like sat and thought about it, so I'm kind of doing this on the fly, but like, one of those, like, we want them to be kind. Right. And we try to model that as much as we can. I think one that probably is a little bit more me than my wife is like, I want them to like find what is like intrinsically motivates them. Mm. Right. And again, like my daughter does 9 hours of dance a week after school. And not once did my wife or I say like, you need to like do something after school, or you need to do more of dance. Like, never did that. So that never came up. We'd like them to kind of know, and this is more my wife, and I've come around to this in the past like 3 to 5 years. We'd like them to be able to experience the full range of emotions. Like, and I don't want to say good and bad emotions, but I will say like trickier emotions and easier emotions, right? And it's so cute. Like, my little one, when she gets angry and frustrated, she's like, she grabs a pillow and yells into the pillow. Mm-hmm. And she's like, I just needed to get this anger out. you know? And I'm like, you definitely did not learn that from me. Like, you either learned it from your mom or you're like so wise. But at the same time, like I as a capitalist, as an entrepreneur, I'm like, the world that they're entering into is not necessarily a particularly like welcoming world. It is a very challenging world economically. Is a very challenging world, you know, climate, you know, technology, like, you know, which is funny, is like a lot of things that I love, you know, technology and economic growth and, you know, upskilling. And so I want them to have this like fundamental skills to thrive in kind of like a modern economy. I don't think my wife feels that strongly about that. And I don't know exactly how to model. Well, maybe I am modeling it by how I've chosen to live my life, but I don't know how to kind of actively downstream that into my kids or if it's even worth it.
I was going to say,
it's necessary.
I think you're modeling a lot through action. I mean, that's where all of the modeling comes from. I mean, words are step one, but this whole idea about emotions, for instance, like, what do you think? Have you explicitly worked on yours? Was it something that was a part of like your development as a dad? Or is it just something that with the space of kind of prioritizing your family, it was something that came a lot easier in terms of learning and managing?
So I grew up in like a immigrant family where emotion, like negative emotions, are still a bad thing that you should never express to others. So I'm very like, I was an emotionally neutered adult, especially when it came to like on both sides, both, you know, positive, I always hate using these words, but you know, positive and negative emotions. So I was stunted where I couldn't like really feel a lot of positive ones. And I was like disassociative where I like ran from the uncomfortable ones. My wife played a big role in that because she's the opposite. And so, you know, and we've both been on like spiritual coaching, getting coached personal journeys. I could do 10 episodes on this stuff, but you know, the key beats there being, you know, like I think meditation, you know, I've been meditating for 11 years now. So meditation kind of just turned the volume down in everything. I know some people view this modality as controversial, but internal family systems, which, you know, was introduced to me through my wife and through some friends, that's played a huge, huge role. And I've done internal family systems. I've been on the receiving end of it for almost 2 years now. I did some attachment work, and I have like I have some insecure attachment kind of traits. And so I kind of, I don't like to say why I played with those, you know, with a teacher. I've done psychedelics, guided psychedelics. That has helped a lot. Not that many times, but like do it like once a year. So I think I wouldn't necessarily say fatherhood has reinforced the importance of evolving. A lot of that has been spearheaded by having a partner that prioritizes it and sees the world very differently than I do. And then having good coaches and friends that are also kind of into that kind of stuff.
First of all, thank you for sharing that. And I have so many questions, but my first one in terms of with your kids, like how do you share with them this journey of like emotional growth? Because I found it super important. Like I had the biggest set of challenges around patience and temper early on with my kids. And I invited them into my like development. I was like, guys, I'm really working hard on like never changing my tone of voice, like, you know, when I'm frustrated or all that stuff. So I want you to know I'm working on it, but I also want you to call me out on it, which in some respects backfired, but in some respects is backfired when like they actually did do something wrong and I should be raising my voice at them. And they're like, you shouldn't raise your voice. And I would be like, you just punched your brother in the face. But in general, like how did you share that with your kids so that they could grow into the people that you're really proud of?
I think some of it is just model, right? So like every morning my daughter wakes up and she sees me meditating. So like she's not particularly interested. I don't prescribe it to her, you know. If she finds it cool, you know, or if she wants my opinion on it, I'll share it. I talk a little bit. You want to be careful, you know, because my parents are their grandparents, but I talk about how I grew up and, you know, how feelings and emotions were not something that we would discuss at home and, you know, things like that. What are some other things? I don't tell them I'm doing psychedelics. Really, we go and meditate. We're going on meditation. We go on a lot of overnight meditation retreats.
Do you cry in front of them?
Oh yeah, for sure. I don't cry that much, but you know, we've had two big losses in the family over the past 5 years, and they've seen a lot of crying, and then I don't really cry other than like loss or fear of loss. But I probably would have hidden that from them before, trying not to show them. I cry in rom-coms a lot, and they're like they always like call me out on it. I'm like, I'm like sensitive, you know. I think when I talk a decent amount, because I'm so like I'm losing my hair like pretty badly in the back, and so I talk a lot about the shame of like losing your hair as a guy to them. How I still feel it, like I feel very ashamed that I'm like balding, and so I talk to them pretty openly about that. And there's no end goal other than like it's something that I'm feeling, like it's an uncomfortable thing, and you know it feels good for me to say it out loud, and then you know I'm sure that they're internalizing it some way.
This is great. And, you know, there's been a big discussion with the fathers that I've worked with through my Founding Fathers program about like crying in front of our kids, because a lot of the dads, their initial reaction was like, that might show weakness and it might scare my kid. And my response was, my experience has been when I cry, I get a deeper connection with my children.
Oh, for sure. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Yeah, we were, I mean, there's this photo of like my father-in-law passed away. I was very close with him 2 years ago. And my wife was at the hospital, so she wasn't home. And she called us to tell us that he had passed. And there's this picture of her and I like wailing. And my wife just like took, you know, like you can take a picture of FaceTime. She like snapped that moment, and I'm like tearing up just thinking about it. And like, we were just like, we were just like the utmost despair in that moment. We were fully in it as individuals and together.
Yeah.
And it's wild that we have a photo of it. I actually haven't seen it since like it happened.
That sounds super powerful. Can you also talk a little bit about family systems? Because I think the majority of the men that are listening don't really understand what that is.
Yeah.
How to think about it from their parents. Yeah,
so internal family systems. And again, there are definitely people that think it's snake oil. So like, do your own research. I think it's been, you know, for my wife and I who have done it separately with different instructors, it's been completely life-changing for ourselves and our marriage. But basically what internal family systems, I think why it works very well for people who are listening to this podcast is that it very quickly like removes you from your rational thing. It's not talk therapy. It's not like, tell me about your relationship with your mother. Like, why was that difficult? Like, what did you say? And then what did she say? It's nothing like that. And the way that I describe it is very much like taking psychedelics. Like, you kind of leave your rational brain and you get into this like embodied sense of self. And so, so what does that mean? Like, the first session I ever did, like, they start, they're like, can you tell me what you're feeling in your body right now? And I'm like, oh, usually like I feel like this like tightness in my chest, you know, like that's where I quote unquote carry my stress. And the therapist asked me, they're like, well, you know, they like kind of breathe into it, pay attention to it. Again, like if you're like a left brain corporate dad, like you, chances are you don't like pay attention to the tingling in your chest, let alone like sit with it, like, you know, with someone guiding it. So you, and then it's like, if that tingling could talk, this is the therapist, like, what would it say? And I said, like, it would say, like, I'm tired. Like, I would, it just keeps saying, I'm tired, I'm tired, I'm tired. And then the therapist goes, and like, can you ask that tingling? Like, what is it that you need? What is it? What does it need right now? And you're already like, you're not even like thinking like in your logical brain, like, what do I need? You're like, there's this like part of me that like, I don't even know what the heck it is, but it's just like, something's happening here. And just out of nowhere, like, it just like, I blurted out, it just wants someone to say thank you. And then I just like exploded into tears. Like, this is like the first 5 minutes. This is actually a Zoom call, because it was like a DIY IFS. It wasn't even like the closed door session. And I just felt this like tiredness and sadness just like coursing through my body. I'm like, what the hell is happening? Right. And so I say that because that kind of frames how you're not like thinking about the tingling. You're like, the tingling is just this thing. And it, you know, like, but somehow you're still interacting with it. That's why it's like, it very much feels like being on drugs, or like plant medicine. What IFS is, though, is that it basically, it's this, I'm going to butcher it a bit, but it basically views the human or the self as this collection of parts, right? And there's like the caring part, and then there's the angry part, and there's the hardworking part. And these parts of all learn to play different roles over time. And there's two roles that they play. There's a manager role where they try to like basically prevent you from getting into trouble. And then there's a firefighter role where once you're in trouble, they kind of like make you feel safe or like put out the trouble. So what's like an example of that? A classic example of a manager is people pleasing, where you are scared of, you might be scared of rejection or criticism. And so, or abandonment, like usually there's like a downstream from that. And so the manager is like, well, if I'm always just pleasant, then no one can ever reject me. Right. And so that's the manager. They're like proactive. And then there's the firefighter, which might be like, this is like one of my big things is like emotional disassociation. Where it's like something happens that you don't like, you get into a fight with someone or someone pisses you off, and you just like, how do you deal with the situation? Like, I would like leave my body. And so what internal family system says is like, there's the, like the main book is called No Bad Parts, is that none of like that disassociative part is not bad, but it's just playing a role, and it might be playing a role that is no longer, it might have been useful before, but it's no longer useful as like a 46-year-old guy. And then the last thing I'll say is like below these parts are what they call exiles, which are real like deep, like inner wounding that might be like, for me, it's like fear of abandonment. And I don't actually know why I have a fear of abandonment, but I just do. And like many of these firefighters and managers all like come back to this like fear of abandonment, which ironically they are ironically curiously, they trace back to, so my dad is a genocide survivor, Cambodian genocide. So one of the theories, and again, like that's the thing about internal family systems, not trying to explain like why you feel that way. It's just like, that's just treated as a fact. You feel that way. And how can you learn to be with those feelings? And a lot of it is actually talking to these parts, like, because they were formed during childhood often. So it's talking to these parts. So like, for example, if your kid said to you, like, every time I go stand in front of the class, I'm so scared that people are going to laugh at me. There's a chance that many adults listening to this podcast have a similar fear. So what IFS would imply, I don't think they would say this, they would, but like a thought process would be, what would you say, like, if your child came to you and said that, like, how would you react? You probably wouldn't say, like, you don't have to be scared. Well, maybe you would. You might just hug them. And into what internal family systems is so magical is because, A, a lot of these parts were built up when you were a child. And B, again, they're not necessarily like rational. Like you wouldn't say like, well, no one's going to kill you because you got the wrong answer. Like that doesn't help.
Right.
When you say that, but that's what our logical brain will say. Like you're not going to die. So why are you so scared of presenting? Like that's not the point. You're missing the point. Right. And so IFS kind of brings in that extra layer, which again is this weird, like, I don't want to call it like self-love, but like, it's like this, like, it's very like self-loving in that regard.
I love this. I also love particularly how you connected at the end, like the biggest solution when your child has a fear like that is just to connect with them, to give them a hug. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. The worst thing is like, you shouldn't be scared when that happens.
Correct. Correct. Correct.
Which is what most people, I used before I did in family, internal family systems, I would be the person that would say that. Mm.
And that comes from your own upbringing for sure. Yeah. Right. Speaking of like, you got into fears a little bit, like what are the biggest fears you're carrying right now as a dad? Like, is there something that's keeping you up at night right now as as a father?
I think that like the mean girl cyberbullying stuff, I think that keeps me up. I think it's such an unknown that like it's gonna happen, right? Like, you know, most kids have phones already at 11 in our neighborhood, unfortunately. So that, especially with my older daughter, because she very much wants to be accepted. And she's gonna like, she's like me in the sense that she will like will her way into getting the outcomes that she wants, which is usually a good thing, but comes at like a pretty heavy, like an internal cost. It can. So that's one. I think living in Southern California, and particularly like we live in a beach community, I think a lot about like just like the body and stuff, like plastic surgery. Like, you know, like my 11-year-old is already, she's like, oh, like there's this like anti-wrinkle cream that I want. I'm like, what the f-? You know, and so I do kind of fear like, you know, GLPs, and you know, like we live in the epicenter of all this stuff, and it's very hard to remove, you know, it's kind of the water that they're swimming in, even though we're not, you know, those kind of people. They're not things that are that important to us. I also, what else do I worry about? I don't really worry. I mean, it's interesting. I don't worry about them like economically. And I think this is good, but it's not. It's like, we're in a position where like we can financially help our kids for a long time. And I'd rather be in that position than not be in that position. But sometimes there's like, it's better to not have an option on some things, right? And so I don't worry, but I wonder, like, how do you give them enough rope so they figure things out while they know they have a safety net? You know, I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was very kind of traditionally middle class, like a pilot, but just a smart real estate investor. He owns 6 homes in LA. And one of his kids knows that he's going to get 3. And the other kid knows that he's going to get the other 3. And one kid he's like, that's house money. Like, when it comes, it comes. The other kid is like living like a retiree because he knows it's coming.
Yes, that is actually a fear that I hear a lot from dads. Like, if we're living in a socioeconomic status where, like, we can give our children, they are not for want of anything that's material. And the worry is, okay, well, then how do I still teach, like, grit and resilience and, like, it, what you talked about earlier, which is this intrinsic motivation, right, to grow and to be. So how do you think, I mean, I can tell you through my observation of you, but how do you think you counteract that? As a family.
Yeah, I think we live well below our means, like relatively, which just sounded crazy, like, because, you know, I've talked about how much rent I paid in my own podcast. But like we just don't, you know, like, I was joking to my wife the other day, is like, my daughter is going to be in the therapist chair being like, my dad never let us get DoorDash ever. Like, I'm anti DoorDash. Where, I mean, I can afford it. I just, like, I'm so against everything it stands for. And so I think, like, we live frugally relative to our means. That's one. We travel a lot. That being said, we travel in a very, like, bougie way. Like, we stay in nice hotels and we eat in nice restaurants. Like, we're not, like, you know, building Habitat for Humanity homes in, you know, Eastern Africa. That's another.
So that's probably counter to it, right? So then, like, what do you
think? I think it's mixed. It's like there's still like exposure to like how other cultures live.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like going to Japan and being like, these apartments are like, yeah, everyone lives in an apartment this tiny. Like, even the rich people. So it's okay. You would survive, right? And just like, I mean, it's gonna sound so cliched, but like, you know, riding in the New York City subway compared to driving around Southern California are two very different like visual experiences. We've struggled a bit as they've gotten busier to take them on to like volunteer trips. So like feeding homeless kids. Again, I model it. Like I mentored a formerly homeless family twice. So try to model it, but I do worry about that.
I mean, I see from my vantage point, your values are modeling it too, right? So, you know, you're not driving every decision based on money. When they ask for things, I guess this is my question to you, when they ask for anything, is the answer, how do you respond to, can I have this new gadget?
Yeah, it's tough because we like, again, the water that we've, and like, that's a choice that I made. I'll tell you a story on this. Is one of my friends, he's a child of immigrants, hedge fund manager, has done extremely well, sends his kid to one of the top private schools in New York City, but he has a rule for his son. And the rule is, you cannot, while you live in my house, you're not allowed to go on a private jet. But here's the problem. His best friend's dad owns a private jet. The kid's best friend. So for the birthday, they go on the private jet and they like fly to Deer Valley or whatever. I'm torn. I'm like so glad I'm not in this situation. I don't think he let him go. But I'm like, and again, given the problems that are happening in the world, this is like the most first world of first world problems. But the kid didn't choose to go to a school where people have private jets. Like, the parents decided that. And so I'm of two schools here. I probably would actually, you know, now that I probably would let them go, but I'd be like really upset about it. I just would internalize the anger. So we have like the water, like we have the iPhone version of that. It's like they get the new iPhone and I'm like, they have the new iPad. Why don't I get? But my daughter does chores and she gets allowance. She gets paid for her chores and she gets money from her grandparents. And yeah, like I want to be like, I was the kid that I'm like, mom, can I have this? The answer was always no. And that kind of messed me up a little bit because it made me so hungry for money just to fill the thing that I like was trained that I couldn't have. And so like, again, it's that delicate line. Like, I don't want, like my daughter is very driven to make money, but it like part of it is like because her dad says no to everything. And, you know, like the private jetties, her friends, like they just want a new article of clothing. Like they just ask their parents and the parent buys it for them. I'm like, well, like, have you done your chores and this? And maybe I'll chip in 20% or what have you, you know? And so I, on the money side, I tend to err on the conservative. Like, I rather you have less of the money and like, your benefits of, you know, being well off will be like no student debt or like, you know, I'll pay for your Ubers when you go drink, you know, whatever. Like that's, you know, you travel, you've been to like 50 countries and you're 11. Like that's how you'll see the wealth drop in your life versus like, you know, the latest Lululemon, you know, sweatshirt that all your friends have.
Totally. So shifting gears a little bit, because I want to ask you about this because it's so kind of core to your evolution in your life. Like for the dads that are high achievers, how do we decouple our identity from external achievement? Because you did that so well, right? And how do you anchor it in something more meaningful? Like,
yeah. Oh man.
When you talk about that, because there are so many dads that one of the biggest topics that's come up in the Founding Fathers program that I run and just in a lot of the blogging has been like, I need to create a very different definition of success. And
yeah,
like they don't know where to start.
I mean, I think that I would approach it two ways. I think that there's the achievement that's like trying to fill a way that you see yourself, like a hole in yourself. Mm. Right. And so, for example, you know, it's funny. You're like, oh, you detach yourself. You know, you did a good job of kind of separating yourself from that. But it's funny. It's like I view it slightly differently where, you know, my Wall Street career was very much focused on like money and status. And then I left, but I kind of like very quickly morphed into like a new status, which is like, it wasn't called being an influencer back then, but it was like a thought leadership, right? And so the new kind of like, oh, I feel good about myself was like, I have all these followers or I've been featured in, you know, all these magazines and publications and so on. And so to the outside world, it might have seemed like I had cracked the code. And don't get me wrong, I had blunted the impact of it, but it's still like that still was there. And so I think that there is these core, and they might be tied to the IFS exiles, but there's like these core fears that's like, well, you know, I think one for me for a long time was like, will people remember me? Mm. Right. And so it's like achievement is just, it's the tool that you brought to the problem of will people remember me? But the challenging part, the thing that's bringing you angst is the fear that you will be forgotten. And I think we can, if you frame it that way, no amount of achievement will fix the fact that we will all be forgotten at some point. So I think that there's like the achievement, like maybe the way that I'm kind of coming up with this on the fly is like, there's the achievement that comes from I lack this. So that achievement is like, it's like gasoline that you're trying to like put into the thing to like keep, to prevent the lack from metastasizing, right? Mm-hmm. But then there's like the healthy achievement. It's like the achievement is like, I feel alive when this thing happens, right? And again, it oftentimes people get promoted to managing director at BlackRock, and they like they think they'll feel alive, but I'll tell you the number of people that got promoted to MD where they didn't feel alive is much higher than the people that felt alive when they got promoted, right? But then, you know, and I'll tell you this, like with my new AI business, is like I have to like pitch people again. And I'm not a natural salesperson. I don't particularly like sales because I actually fear rejection. But I'm very passionate about the thing that I'm selling, and I'm not selling it to like make money. I'm selling it because I genuinely believe in the thing that I'm doing, which completely reframes it away from sales. And like, if so, like I'll tell someone like, hey, I don't want to bombard you. If like, this is the last time I'm going to ask you if you're interested in this. And then I won't email with you. Not like some people do that as like a sales technique. I do it because like, I just want to be respectful of the person that I'm selling to. But by selling this way, my sales are through the roof. Right. And so, you know, there's like a healthy achievement. There's something I'm doing, I'm really excited about it, and I want to communicate it to you in like a responsible way. And yeah, if they say yes, like that's the achievement, because like there's a great fit, right? Not you trick them with some like scammy sales technique that like, you know, gave them FOMO. And so I think I would encourage people to kind of, I think a lot of achievement, particularly around men, is dominated by the, like, this is what I lack. So how do I like fill it up?
Mm-hmm.
And so I would encourage you, I mean, there's countless ways to heal that. I've listened to a few throughout this conversation. And then I think that there's this other thing, which maybe achievement isn't even the right word. I like to use the word aliveness. Like if I follow aliveness, I'm usually not like strayed to the wrong location.
Mm-hmm.
And because I'm hardworking, because I have half a brain, like usually if I follow aliveness, like good things happen, right? And many people would call them achievements. But to me, I just kept following aliveness, and like this was the result.
So interesting. Thank you. We're getting close to the end of our time. What I wanted to ask, you know, fatherhood and is so messy. And so I always like to close the podcast with a question about like a messy moment when it comes to when your kids were really young. Did you have a like ridiculous diaper blowout or something crazy, a vomit on an airplane, or do you have a fun story related to that?
Yeah. So because I'm frugal, one of the biggest fights we have with my wife is upgrading on airlines. And so I'm very much like, it took a successful AI business at 46 for me to pay the extra like $35 to pick my seat. Like that's the level of frugality on things that I deem to be not worth it. Like, you know, but you know, like this t-shirt was like $70. So like I pick my spots. So we did this trip with just my one daughter. And we were gonna fly like the middle tier of Singapore Air, which is like first class, like on an American airline. And my wife and I think we might have used some points and some cash. Just I was like, this is so like, because it's like 3x the price, maybe more. I'm like, that's crazy. I'd rather take three trips to Asia than to spend it all on this one trip. But you know, happy wife, happy life. And so we did it, and we're going from Tokyo to LA. My daughter's one. We're on the Tokyo Express rail waiting for the last stop. And my daughter takes her pacifier that's like attached, the Wubba Nubs. It's like attached to like a frog. and she just launches it on the train tracks. So that's gone, and we have like that backup, like the old school pacifiers, but the shape's different, and so she won't use it. So we get on this plane and we're like toasting. We're like, oh, I could get used to this first class, you know, business class or whatever, premium economy. I could get used to this champagne, caviar. Like, this is cool. Maybe you were right this whole time. And our daughter starts to want to go to sleep, but we don't have a pacifier. So we just keep giving her more milk. And so we're giving her more milk. I'm giving her more milk. And then the plane takes off and it's like it's a red eye. And within like 5 to 7 minutes, she just projectile vomiting like gallons of milk. And you know that like raw milk baby smell?
Yeah.
Like it's like mixed with like stomach bile. So just like vomiting on this like 12-hour flight. And not only that, but she's yelling uncontrollably because she doesn't have anything to soothe her. She's throwing up. We were still so young in parenthood. I don't think we had like a change of clothes for ourselves.
Yeah.
Right. I think from that point on, we always had one for ourselves. But at that point, we only had one for her. So we reek of that puke smell. She's screaming for an hour. There's like all these like, you know, Japanese and, you know, Western businessmen trying to do work. Like, you know, like you and I have been in that situation. You're like, oh, I got a 10-hour flight. I've left 8 hours of work to do it at this 10-hour flight. And yeah, she finally falls asleep. We're covered in puke. We smell like there's no like salvaging ourselves. And we get into the car. My friend picks us up and in his like single guy in his Lexus. And he's like, God, you guys really smell. I'm like, yeah, sorry. Like, this happened. My daughter proceeds to throw up all over his car on the ride home to the airport. So that was the messy one.
Wow, that is messy. Awesome. Thank you so much for everything you've shared today. And thank you for being so like honest and vulnerable about your journey and growth like as a person. I think that's really important for all the other dads to hear. So really appreciate it. Good luck in this new partially closing magic window, opening new like area of
rap concerts.
Yeah, rap concerts and work. So thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. And thanks to everyone listening.